dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, we're going to conclude the final section of the penultimate chapter in Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity. As I did last week, I'm going to begin the show with the reading and then follow it with a talk that I think resonates with Eisenstein's words in a remarkable way.
There's another writer from the east to the west to hold you alive in this darkness.
In love with the world. The last section describes how an emerging language of truth will transform the human drama from an unconsciously scripted tragic comedy into a conscious play, a great work of the storyteller's art. Through language, humanity will become a conscious agent of the universe's unfolding. Pruned of the tangle of excess verbiage that obscures meaning, representational language will be a richer and more meaningful realm than what we have today. Nonetheless, in many important areas of life, language, and especially written language, will play a reduced role. That is because, like reason, like linear technology, like money, the gift of language has exceeded its proper domain. We use words to express many things that words are fundamentally incapable of expressing, and most words express nothing at all. There are signs that the shrinkage of the domain of language that will accompany the Age of Reunion is already beginning to happen. It is a response, I think, to the crisis of language I wrote about in Chapter 2, in which words seem to mean less and less, forcing us into increasingly exaggerated elocutions to communicate at all, in which advertising has become ubiquitous and wholly insincere, in which politicians lie routinely and get away with it, and in which we discount nearly all public speech as PR, spin, and hype. Living in a ubiquitous matrix of lies, we naturally respond by discounting all speech. Because of its ubiquity, especially of the printed word, we tune it out. Because of its insincerity, we discount it and second-guess it. Faced with this crisis, young people in particular are drifting toward other ways of communicating. This may be one of the deep reasons behind the astonishing decline in literacy over the past generation. Ask a retiring college professor about it. When I began teaching at Penn State a few years ago, I was shocked to discover that many of my students could not read. They could scan through a page and pull out answers, but they were seemingly incapable of integrating ideas over an entire paragraph, nor could they write coherently. Compared to the standards of 100 years ago, Americans are shockingly illiterate. Yet we are no less intelligent and no less hungry for communication. To one extent, declining literacy represents another robbery of our spiritual capital, the sell-off of yet another cognitive capacity. But another major factor could be a semi-conscious moral repugnance at the inanity and inauthenticity of the words that inundate us today. Fed up with lies, young people in particular turn increasingly to music and other modes of non-textual expression. I think I see the beginning of a trend. One sign is the exploding popularity of websites such as MySpace, Facebook, and YouTube, where, thanks to technology, people share, in addition to words, photographs, music, voice, and video. Meanwhile, the established commercial interests are fighting a desperate battle against the democratization of music production and distribution that technology has made possible. Almost anyone can produce, record, and distribute music and video at minimal cost. The technological infrastructure is in place for a return to the gift economy and only awaits the demise of the extractive, centralizing, interest-based financial system we have now. The dominance of text in remote communication may be coming to an end, a momentous development, for it could signal the end of an era that started with the printing press some 5 centuries ago. Of course, there are functions for which text is uniquely suited, and books will surely survive in one form or another. But the written word's monopoly on public and long-distance communication, eroding ever since the age of radio, is coming to an end. Words will reign in a more circumscribed realm. On the web, podcasts and video streaming may soon eclipse words as the dominant media of communication. Already, a lot of people prefer audiobooks over the written versions. Video-capable cell phones have replaced letter writing, nearly a lost art. I wonder if real literacy will retreat to the 3% or so of the population it comprised in pre-modern times. Whether or not it is mediated by technology, could we be initiating a halting return to the lingua adamica of old? Or will the regime of separation continue to new extremes, a VR world of avatars and voice simulators where nothing is real? I envision a future in which we return to the voice, the song, and the face in communication. The Piraha, whose communication is mostly singing and humming, show us the future as well as the past. At least they show us a future possibility. I may be wrong, after all. Maybe the age of reunion will never come. Not in our lifetimes, not in 1,000 years. Or perhaps both worlds will coexist, and we as individuals shall choose which we live in. In any event, the most important dimension of a return to unmediated communication is direct and personal. There are signs of this as well. Transformational technologies such as authentic movement, contact improv, and the continuum TM that help people reclaim some of the vocabulary of the original language of body and voice. I encourage you to try them out. An actual experience of the intimacy of communication that is possible without words will be far more effective than this book in persuading you that an age of reunion is possible, imminent, right there in front of us. Only our fears, habits, and beliefs keep it hidden. The lingua adamica, the mythic original language of humankind, admits no lying and no separation between subject and object. There is no need to infer as to the state of being of the utterer, for her vocalizations are facets of that state. To understand the real voice of another person requires and furthers an intimacy so profound as to dissolve the boundaries between self and other. These days, such intimacy typically exists only between mother and infant, sometimes between father and infant, and on occasion between the most trusting of lovers in special moments. I believe that in former times, before the age of separation was much underway, such intimacy was the rule in human relationships of the Stone Age kin band. Language, as we know it today, was unnecessary. Reports, some by respected anthropologists, abound that describe aboriginal communication abilities that border on the telepathic. Such communication was not limited to human relationships, for people in those times enjoyed a profound intimacy with nature that, by many accounts, allowed them to understand the languages of animals, plants, forests, wind, and clouds. These languages are so unlike the abstract systems of signs that constitute language today that we probably shouldn't even call them by that name. Today's languages are a corruption, a degeneration, at times an imitation, but usually an obfuscation of the original lingua Adamica. To communicate in the original language involves a temporary fusion of self and other. It is to be the other that is speaking. To understand the other so deeply that its essence is displayed nakedly in its sounds, odors, and motions. It is as impossible to lie in the lingua Adamica as it is to fake an odor. We can hide it, mask it, or suppress it, but it is always there, underneath. When we bear our true voice to another and really hear the voice behind the words, boundaries dissolve into an unutterably sweet intimacy. This requires total trust, which is impossible when we see the world as competing others, and so happens very rarely today. In the age of reunion, we will grow gradually less attached to these boundaries. We will be unafraid to relinquish them at will, so that we can live in a profound richness of relationship. To a person living in such intimacy with other people and all others, life is suffused at every moment with a depth of meaning that we can hardly imagine today. To simply sit and do nothing can be an overwhelmingly sensuous experience. The bliss of such a state is so intense that there is hardly reason to do anything but just be. Language of any kind of conceptualization removes us from this state and deprives the world of meaning. Yet, is there a possibility of being simultaneously attuned to both, to word and to voice? Why have we embarked upon the sojourn of separation that began with language? The longing for that state of bliss, buried deeply within all of us, drives us never to be satisfied with the lesser world of separation we have created. I know this because I have had the fortune to experience the lingua Adamica, though just a few times in fullness. Separated by a telephone wire, I and this other merged so completely through voice that there was no distinction between I and thou. In every sound, her total being was manifest to me and mine to her. Language is utterly insufficient to convey the intensity of this union. Words like mine and her imply a separation that did not exist. A homecoming awaits beneath our names, our numbers, our words, and our physical separation. You have been waiting for it your whole life. Sometimes it wells up and we run before it to save ourselves. But its trace remains as a promise and a reminder of what life should, can, and will be. Communication in the lingua adamica is an occasion of profound intimacy between the communicants, and it is absolutely specific to them. There are as many original languages as there are pairs of communicants. To a third party not sharing their intimacy, the lingua adamica would have no more meaning than so many bird songs. Only the grossest emotional states would be apparent. To the intimate, however, a single noise communicates an infinity of nuance. Not only are no two lingua adamicas the same, but no two words are ever the same between two people. Each communication is unique, just as each moment is unique. There is no reduction of the infinitude of experience. Speaking the original language is much like making love, and indeed it is no coincidence that the vocalizations of sexual passion are among the few outbreakings of the lingua adamica in modern adults. But someday we will be in love with a world. A trace of the lingua adamica can be found in poetry and music. Poets and poetically inclined prose writers know that the melodic structure precedes and partly determines the structure of the text in poetry. We can only imagine what poetry would be without words. It would be a song, a ululation of non-referential sounds, nonetheless laden with meaning, perhaps akin to the spontaneous scatting of jazz vocalists or the spirit songs gifted to Native American vision questers. Spontaneity is a key feature of this sort of communication. It is not a colonization of the other, not an imposition of one's own categories, not a reduction of the world into a finite collection of labels. According to Joseph Epps Brown, Native Americans insist that the songs used in their ceremonies are never composed, but are rather given by spirits. The lingua adamica is not only our distant heritage, but also our birthright and our future. The process by which it is learned is wholly different from that of learning any other language. Whereas a language of symbols necessarily involves an equating of A to B, and thus a separation and alienation, the lingua adamica embodies the uniqueness of each A and B, each part of the whole and each moment in time, and it requires a coming together, not a separation. To learn the lingua adamica requires a dropping of the artificial boundaries that keep us apart, a dropping of the conventions of me and mine. To speak it with an other means falling in love with that other to the point where it is no longer an other. The more intimate and trusting the love, the more liberty to let down the barriers of self, the more highly developed the understanding of the mutual lingua adamica, and the less necessary ordinary words become. If to speak the lingua adamica with another is to fall in love with that other, then to understand the languages of plants, animals, and inorganic processes requires nothing less than to fall in love with the world. The lingua adamica emerges with the melting of barriers between self and world. As the futility, artificiality, and factiousness of those barriers becomes increasingly apparent with the breakdown of modern society, we will find ourselves speaking less and coming naturally into our birthright. To learn the language of the world, what a beautiful and fruitful definition of science that would be. Science, to learn the language of the world so as to fall more deeply in love with it. How different that is from the mentality of mastery and control, from the Baconian inquisition of nature. It begins with the awe of the scientist apprehending the cell, the stars, the complexity of an ecosystem or a metabolism, the miracle of life. It is a return to the presence of the divine in nature. It is the culmination of the journey of science, which chopped nature up into pieces, isolated it and refined it, purified it and reduced it, only to discover at every turn unsuspected new realms of beauty, wonder, and miracles. The loss of the particular that comes with the generic categorizations of label and number is a cause and a symptom of our falling out of love with the world. Conversely, when we fall in love, we see our beloved as a real, unique individual, irreplaceable. The age of reunion is nothing more or less than a falling back in love with the world. Nothing, not even an electron, is generic. All are unique individuals, special and therefore sacred. In physics, the quest of four centuries to reduce complex reality to universal laws acting on generic fundamental particles is collapsing. As the variety of, quote, fundamental particles multiplies, as known physical forces stubbornly resist unification, and as we digest the fact of indeterminacy, even an electron has an irreducible individuality, an unpredictability to its behavior that is not merely an illusory consequence of our ignorance of more minute causes. Not enslaved to cause, it is an autonomous chooser. As with the electron, so with the proton, the neutron, and everything made of them. Moreover, this individuality is not a separately existent property, but only intelligible in relation to the rest of the universe. In particle physics, we see it in the phenomenon of a measurement, which is really just a relationship manifest. In biology, we see it in the web of relationships that define and sustain any organism. In human psychology, the same principle accords us a status as absolutely unique individuals, whose individuality is an infinite set of relationships to the rest of the world. When we fall in love with the world, we will perceive and treat everything as sacred. Conventional religion sees some things as sacred and others as mundane, inert, and interchangeable masses. To be sacred is to be imbued with a specialness, uniqueness, and divine purpose. To see something that way is to fall in love. The Age of Reunion is a return to the original religion of animism. No longer will we divide the universe into the sacred and the profane, the spiritual and the mundane. Everything will be sacred because we know that everything is unique, even each electron, each drop of water, and certainly each human being. We know this already, of course. We have known it for a long time, but relegated it to the realm of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, "You are special," or half-understood lines of scripture as we continue to label and judge people and groups of people. Let us imagine a world where it is the basis of life. It is coming, the more beautiful world predicted in so many myths. A world alive with spirit and a spirituality alive in the world. The core message of New Age spirituality is, you are divine. From Deepak Chopra to the Gospel of Thomas, from Louise Hay to the Bhagavad Gita, the teaching of the indwelling divinity of all things foretells the spirituality of the Age of Reunion. Instead of spurning the material world for higher things, it loves and embraces the material world and treats all as sacred. In holistic medicine, we will love our patients. Holistic economics will grow from love of people and their work. Each job will be unique. And holistic science will love the processes of the universe itself. All along, that has been our innate yearning, simply to love and be loved. We feel its stirrings, but fear to act on them. So enslaved are we to survival anxiety and the logic of the machine. The former is the feeling of not being able to afford to act from our humanity, and we respond to it with a program of control. The latter is the categorization of every person or object as a generic example of one or another type, to be addressed through the professional, dispassionate, and objective application of method. The convergence of crises will lay bare the fraudulence of the logic of the machine, as well as the futility of the program of control. No longer will fear or ideology keep us from falling back in love with the world. As a result, all the old dualisms will crumble. There will be no distinction between a personal relationship and an economic relationship. Economic relationships will be personal. There will be no distinction between work and play. All work will be playful. There will be no distinction between science and religion. Both will lead us to love the world and understand more fully our role in the unfolding cosmic pattern. There will be no distinction between work and art. Both will seek to participate in the creation of beauty. All of this and more will spring from the dissolution of the greatest dualism of them all, that between self and other. That is not to say we will merge into undifferentiated oneness. Nature is not like that, and neither are we. The discrete and separate self will not disappear, but will become more fluid, more playful, no longer a permanent, irrevocable feature of our reality. We will feel and define our individuality through relationships to everything else. No longer will we think in terms of having relationships, but in terms of being relationships. As our relationships change and grow, so will we, thereby participating in and contributing to the growth of the whole. A psychic once told me of a vision of the, quote, million years of dreaming that is to follow the collapse of the present world. In a dream, the world is malleable to the mind's reshaping and the distinction between subject and object fluid. One interpretation would be the fulfillment of the technological program, in which nanotechnology makes reality malleable to our every whim. But maybe the vision means something quite different. In a dream, the fluidity of perspective allows us to be first one character, then another, then to see it all from the outside, then to be the entire dream, which is, after all, supposedly all in our head. The million years of dreaming is not the imposition of our dreams of domination onto reality, but our participation in the universe's dreaming of itself. In love, we identify with an other, see and feel the world from its perspective, and so realize our essential unity. So also in a dream, by falling back in love with the world, we enter the cosmic dream, and in releasing our discrete and separate selves, grow into who we are. And that is the conclusion of Chapter 7, The Age of Reunion, from The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. Next week, we'll begin the final chapter of the book in what has been a very long haul, and I thank you again for sticking with it. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD, Kasilof, Anchorage, WZKW, Kingsville, KOWA, Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. For the rest of the program, I'm going to play you a talk that echoes many of the ideas that Eisenstein has raised in the preceding sections, but from a very different sort of person, the founder of Human Rights Radio, an unlicensed FM radio station in Springfield, Illinois. Mbana Kantako spoke at the University of Illinois on February 19, 1998, in honor of a decade of micropower radio broadcasting in Springfield. Some of those stations that exist as a consequence of what Mbana Kantako unwittingly started are the ones broadcasting my words this very moment. I'd like to thank my friends Richard Edmondson and Annie Voice, formerly of San Francisco Liberation Radio, for making this talk available so many years ago, and to my friend David Adelson for reminding me of its existence, as I've never played it on this show before.
To the ancestors, to the elders, to the adults, to the children, to the unborn, whether you're with us this afternoon or amongst those who may hear this over Human Rights Radio, Zilango. It's a greeting we use to basically try to make everybody feel comfortable. It means come let us co-create something beautiful out of love and truth. And that's really what we've been trying to do at Human Rights Radio, though we didn't know it even back in the day when it was called WTRA. And I guess that's what we're here to talk about. Our work at Human Rights Radio and what we feel it's about. If you read quite a few national magazines and so forth, you'll find that they refer to us as the founder of the micro radio movement. I got to be honest with you, never in our work did we ever discuss becoming a part of a micro radio movement. Never in our work did we discuss anything like that. From the very beginning, our efforts were toward addressing the wrongs that our people were enduring in this country. So back in the day, I guess summer of 87, when we were discussing the development of what's now grown to be Human Rights Radio, it wasn't with we had no intent of saying, hey, if we do this, we'll be the first ones in the country to do. Our intentions when we started up the station was simply to address the unfair situation that our people were being subjected to. And at the time, from the title of the station, you can tell we thought it was really like a landlord-tenant matter. WTRA stood for W Tenants' Rights Association. We wasn't really trying to do anything, but we thought, from the way we had been propagandized, that within the confines of the system, there were steps one could take to address injustices, and if one would take those steps, then those injustices would be dealt with. Well, we went that way. We went, and I can remember going to, say, the criminal operation called the Springfield Housing Authority at the time, and I was asking them for a copy of their HUD manuals, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, Rules of Life of Our People. They had these manuals that the Housing Authority had, and I remember getting them, and man, each of them was about 4 inches thick, and I remember taking them to the house, and I remember just telling myself, all you need to do is learn what's in these books, and man, when you start running it down to them, everything gonna change. Well, we learned quite a bit what was in those books, and when we went to our first confrontation with the Housing Authority on the first thing that they informed us once they saw how aware we was of the contents of those books was that those books are outdated. We got some new ones now. That's devastating, man, when you take all that time to, get up on all these different information to find out that, well, it really forced us to question what we was doing then. And about the same time our Creator blessed us, so many times we can't name them all, but around the same time, and we ran into a brother by the name of Sosia Kankaji. And I got to say, by the Creator's permission, we've been blessed to have an opportunity to study with some of the best teachers around. One in this room, Brother Michael Townsend, and Brother Muhammad Salam out of Atlanta, Georgia, a Muslim. And we studied with Yahweh Ben Yahweh, the leading Hebrew in the country, for quite some time. We had an opportunity to sit at the feet of many folks that had knowledge to share with us. But at the time, we just got kicked around by the housing. We were sitting at the feet of a brother by the name of Sosia Kankaji. And I was letting him know how disappointed I was that I had did all that studying on them books, and then they told me that the books were irrelevant. And he was saying, well, brother, you know, you ought to start thinking about rules that they can't change. Well, hell, I never knew nothing like that in my life, rules that they can't change. And he started talking to me about human rights. And at the time, I was like, wait a minute, what is human rights? And he said, these are the rights you're born with, brother. And I thought, oh, here we go again. They done finally got somebody that's going to try to take the militancy out of our work. Get us to do some of this old pray all night kind of work. You know what I'm saying? And so we didn't really want to hear about human rights. But the more we became trying to make ourselves aware of different things like the rules regarding voter registration. Yeah, that was one other thing we ran into. We was registering folks to vote because, you know, we again thought in the beginning that within the confines of the system, we could address the injustices and they would be dealt with. So we registered the group we was with called the Tenants' Rights Association, WTRA stood for. We registered more folks to vote probably than any organization of its kind in the city of Springfield. And what we thought, well, we're running here, we're doing our best to register folks, and once we came up with the idea, you know, they got them little voting things that they got to use when you do finally get to the polls that maybe some of our people are a little unsure about using. If we could get one of them and take to the homes when we register people, we could, like, get rid of some of the apprehensions in the people about voting. We looked in the rules of the voting thing, in the registering thing. There was no rules against it whatsoever. But when we brung it up to the election commission, you thought we'd grow the tail when we was talking to them. Man, they went off. No, we can't do it. Well, show us where it says you can't do it at then. And there was nothing that said they couldn't do it. But they chose not to allow us to do it. And oh, when we started up the radio station, you know, it's kind of clear. We looked at the situation and there was no rules about no radio station under 100 watts. There was no rules whatsoever about a radio station with less than 100 watts. So who in the world would get upset when someone would start one that's 0.4 watts? Not even a half of a watt. Those that write the rules got upset about it. Well, you know, when you keep on trying to go by the rules and you notice that every time you get the rules down pat and you come to the arena to do battle that they change the rules, pretty soon if you're intelligent, sooner or later you got to say, wait a minute now. And more I try to deny it, the more it made sense, this human rights discussion. These rights that we be born with, the right to live, the right to grow, the right to be what one was created to be, the more those rights started to sound good to us. And we tried to follow what was happening with the political situation, and it came to our attention that every legislative session, the spring session, the criminal operation called the Illinois State Legislature, they passed 1,400 new laws. Went down the Capitol building one time and ran into the book of laws, thicker than you is tall. And ain't none of y'all in this room can stand up and tell us that you're a law-abiding citizen for certain, because you don't know what the laws are. And if you learn the ones from last year, they got 1,400 new ones for you this year. Boy, those human rights start sounding better and better. And when the FCC showed up in 1989 to tell us that we was breaking a law that they hadn't even wrote, boy, those human rights start sounding even better and better. But we stuck with WTRA until the visit of the FCC. And then it was clear that this system was a crooked system. You got to understand, we wasn't just dealing with the information that we had gathered in our efforts, but we had generations of evidence that this was not a good situation to be trying to do good up in. We had generations of evidence. It wasn't just our own, but when you throw in your own life experiences, I tell people that say, I got to go vote because I feel, I say, you better go ahead and do that. Because had somebody told me not to register folks to vote at the time my mind was set up like that, I'd have told them to go to hell. I'm going to get my rights, I would have told them. If somebody would have told me not to march on City Hall for some voting rights, I'd have told them to go to hell. I thought that was a solution because my mind had been prepared to think that way. You couldn't have stopped me if you wanted to. And that's why I won't try to stop you. All I can do is share with you the experiences that we had, and maybe in doing so, it might make you see the futility in it. They tell me that it takes $300,000 to get a seat in the legislature for the state of Illinois. Ain't never heard nobody talk about how many votes it takes. They said it takes $300,000. And I would conclude that those that would make the $300,000 available have bought themselves a mouthpiece. And those that didn't make the $300,000 available, oh well. Yeah, you don't want to talk about human rights because I know at first I thought it was a weak thing. I thought it would, you know. But then I realized that the real question about our ability to deal with human rights was based on what value we placed on our right to exist. Yeah, folks would like to say, well, I ain't into that human rights thing because I think you're full of shit, man. When in truth, you're not into the human rights thing because when you think about it, you haven't yet placed any value on yourself. And that was the challenge that I was given at the time Brother brung it to us about human rights. What value did we place on ourselves? None. Because we were begging for permission to do what we were born with a right to do. The difference between WTRA and Human Rights Radio is the difference between civil rights and human rights. It's the difference between hip-hop and rap. Begging and asserting your rights. It's that deep. But see, this whole question of how you will or if you will be able to deal with the question of human rights, it ain't got nothing to do. Well, I might be able to move you toward that if I'm blessed to find the right words and arrange them in the right way. But after that, it's still going to come down to what you think about yourself. When you look around the creation, it don't take long to realize that we're the only ones in the creation that's being charged to live. It don't take long to realize why that is. We're in a situation where the rights that one is born with is the last thing on the agenda. I can remember studying one of them Lincoln-Douglas debates. Douglas was sweating Lincoln. He was on Lincoln about the fact, you know, what Lincoln was saying to Douglas, hey, man, what's up with slaves, you know, this here whole thing about these slaves and their rights. And Douglas said, look, what you're talking about is a question that was resolved when we wrote the Constitution. Human rights versus business rights. We resolved that when we wrote the Constitution. And that's what folks need to comprehend. The Constitution was not just a crime against African people, but the Constitution was a crime against humanity because it took and it said that it was legal to deny human rights. Now that is a crime beyond all crimes. If I wish to go out to this little pond out here and dump some whatever off into the pond, I'm sure the pond police would be on my case, wouldn't they? If I wanted to go out and dump something on the Ring Road out there, I'm sure the Ring Road police would be on my case, wouldn't they? If I wanted to pollute the yard or I wanted to mess over the bald eagle or something, or everyone recognizes the rights of these things to exist as they were created to exist, but everyone has a big problem with the right of people to exist as they were created to exist. I don't know if you get a chance to watch these nature shows on TV. And I'm one of those that know that you better check everything you check out on the media. But if they're half right on those nature shows about the way these different creatures are created and the abilities that they've been given, one has to stop and think about yourself then. What might you may have been made capable of? Let's see. I don't know, I was listening to some story and they said that physically there's like a 3% difference between people and, say, some members of other upright walking families. So we know that the difference between people and upright walking beings has got to be something that you can't measure just simply in the flesh. The United Nations, in the first article of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which they put together in 1948, our great creator spirit knew that if we had to talk to folks in this day, in this slave state about human rights, we better have some kind of evidence that somebody else is talking about it. So by our creator's permission, we bring your attention to Universal Declaration of Human Rights, put out by the United Nations. They put it together in 1948 as not a statement of their power to bestow upon folks rights, but as recognition that they know that folks is born with rights, human beings, they call them. And in Article 1, they set to define what a human being was. And they said all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and in rights. You pick up the Constitution, they say that I'm a three-fifths of a person. How in the hell could I even think of I have a right to some dignity when they write down in the rules of the road, if you will, that I'm three-fifths of a person? And they ain't took it out today. You can go look in there. There ain't no provisions to really eliminate the condition that brought my people here in the first place. I know, the 13th Amendment, read it. No person shall be held in slavery or servitude unless they have been duly convicted of a crime. Did you know it said that? Maybe that's got something to do why the prison population has gone up the way it has. And you can't get a decent salary at work no more. Competing against slave labor would make it difficult, wouldn't it? Would make it extremely difficult. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and in rights, and they are endowed with, born with, they say, reason, a mind, and conscience. This is what separates us from all the other living creatures in the creation, this conscience. It's not something we can put in a cup, not something we can put down on a piece of paper, but it's in the way we conduct our relationships within the family of living beings. If I was to walk into this room and found that all of you had been ripped to shreds and blood was everywhere, it would be an intelligent question to ask, what kind of animal came through this place? Wouldn't that be an intelligent question to ask? Certain behavior is characteristic of animals. If a dog going down the street meowing, certainly we're going to have a teach-in on that, ain't we? We've already in our minds decided what a dog is supposed to do, and if a dog deviates, then we call in the question, what that, if that is in fact the dog. If in fact the human being is born with a conscience, how the hell can one live up in this country without questioning everything going on? You think about the conditions of the people. The top 1% of the population having a greater net wealth than the bottom 95% of the population. Let me tell you what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about if you take everything everybody owns and you turn it into cash and you pay all their bills, the top 1% got more wealth than the bottom 95%. And they're going to tell me that hard work is going to get you paid. The bottom 90% ain't getting paid too good. The stock market is booming, but yet 10% own 90% of all of it. And 1% of that population owns 99% of that. They say you can't make no new money unless you got what? Old money. But for 11 generations, my folks was denied any return on their work. What kind of conscience does this country got? And I didn't say that that was an element in the human being. The UN said that that was the element in the human being. I hear folks say, it's a damn shame Bill Clinton is acting up. This country was so good before Bill Clinton. And I'd like to know when. What is your criteria for good? We review the data that's available today, as we did throughout our days at Human Rights Radio. And of course, we had to move from WTRA. We went to Zoom Black Magic, but then there were some folks that had another program that picked up that name we wasn't interested in no more. We went to Black Liberation Radio. I'm going to tell you something. I read the Emancipation Proclamation. It don't say black in there one time. I read the Fugitive Slave Law. It don't say black in there one time. Isn't that devastating? Do you know what that means? It wasn't just a black thing on the side of a slaveholder or the slave. But we've all been purposely miseducated, you know? You read them. Find the word black in there any time. In either one of those documents. The Fugitive Slave Act wasn't just any kind of an act. It spoke about things like, say, if one of you knew that I was acting like I'm acting and you didn't go tell, they could charge you $1,000. You think about if they charge you $1,000 in 1998, wouldn't that put you behind the eight ball? What about they charge you $1,000 in the 1830s, the 1850s? They'd just about do you up, wouldn't you? You'd about go tell on Jesus then, wouldn't you? It's sad that folks have been so miseducated that they could proclaim this to be a free country while slavery's going on. If you derived a living from what you call work, how much of what you actually had coming did you get when you knew you were competing against free slave labor? As we grew at the radio station, you noticed the names grew. The names changed. We certainly could look and find big time data. In fact, they asked the military fellow that was in charge of that one of the many government invasions of other sovereign nations, Panama. They asked him, why did y'all attack? Y'all looking for Noriega, right? He said, yeah, we was looking for Noriega. Why'd y'all go to the low-income black neighborhood in Panama City and attack them? They said, well, our objective was to take out those people that would keep shooting at us. Not the ones that were, but the ones that would keep shooting at us. You can find all kind of government documents that would show that the center of the government's surveillance, control, is in the low-income black community. But that ain't the only folks they mess with. 58% of all white men are going to get arrested sometime in their lifetime. Now, it's certain 90% of all black men are going to get arrested sometime in their lifetime, but who would have ever guessed it was 58% of all white men? When you start talking about the top 1% got more wealth than the bottom 90%, you're still talking about 95%. You're talking about a whole bunch of white folks, ain't you? Ain't you? You're talking about almost three times as many white folks living in poverty in this country as you're talking about black folks in this country. I thought it was a white thing. We thought it was a black thing when we went through the Black Liberation Radio thing. And certainly we thought when we turned to Black Liberation Radio, all the black middle class would be supportive of the work that we're doing. But we found that they used it as a cover to further perpetuate the crimes that they had carried out as black slave owners. You know there were black slave owners in this country? Black slave owners. Yep, own on the average of twice as many slaves as the white slave owners. Some would say, well, that's because there were so few, but who would have ever guessed there were one? Only one state made it illegal for blacks to own whites. That was Virginia. More than likely why the South chose it as its capital. Well, when we changed the name from Black Liberation Radio, we first then went to African Liberation Radio. And then we started examining the symbols and signs on the back of the dollar bill. We thought that is too broad of a term. We do not want to include ourselves in that. So Human Rights Radio. We thought by changing the name to Human Rights Radio that every time we would say this word, you would challenge people to think better of themselves. Kind of hard to do in a system that's designed to beat you down every day, all day. It's kind of hard to think better of yourself. Kind of hard to think anything of yourself. In fact, what you would probably prefer to do is just talk about whether you think I make sense or I don't make sense. Why, as I stand up here trying to challenge you to think better of yourself. Over time, with the radio, we've learned, we've grown, been blessed to learn a lot of things, but the thing that's kept us going is that we were seeking the truth. We were seeking to find out what the real deal was. And so when it came clear that it wasn't a Tenants' Rights Association matter, we had the strength to change the direction. When it became clear that it wasn't a voting rights matter, we were blessed with the strength to change the direction. Our get-together today is to challenge you to find the strength in you, to seek an alternative way of relating to this thing called life as opposed to the one that has been imposed upon all of us. Yeah, I know. It's kind of hard. We was talking down in the cafeteria before we come up here. Why is it that folks hold on to hope in the system? Is the elders would explain it that you would have to be able to see there to be a creator before you could actually say, let's do something different than this. Without really being able to see there as a creator, you'd probably think that we better hold on to this because without this, we gonna have trouble. My folks ain't never knowed nothing but trouble because of this. We're in a new time, a very new time. when we stood up here, probably out here somewhere on this campus 10 years ago, and talked about the fact that we was getting ready to start up the station, I'm sure some applauded because they thought this will get rid of them. But our ability to be on 3,000 tonight will make 3,294 nights. Our ability to maintain a broadcast throughout this time is proof that our great creator spirit never lied to the elders. Because when we asked the elders, why was we allowed to go through this situation, this Holocaust? They told us it was about making us a better people. I was talking to Brother Michael Townsend about this at the table this afternoon. I said, you know, Michael, if you go ask people about changing the way things are done in this country, a lot of folks ain't going to be too willing to even think about that after all they done been through already up in this country. Can you imagine what it was like before this experience, trying to convince people that there would be a need to deal with conflict? If folks don't see a need to deal with it now, after this experience, then you can bet most folks never will. Is there a class out here on human rights? There's one out here on public affairs, though, right? A whole department, right? And they got a class on opening corn or cans of corn, but none on human rights. I mean, you think about that. Because if you notice there's one thing that's missing no matter where you go, it's discussion of human rights. It's all right if we're talking about China, ain't it? It's all right if we're talking about Haiti, ain't it? It's all right if you're talking about Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, but when you look in the mirror, you better see a slave. Is that why you don't talk about it? Is that why? I mean, I don't hear the dignified folks talking about it. On the college campus, you can comprehend why it ain't a lot of discussion in Evergreen or Brandon. I don't hear the middle class talking about human rights. I used to think, oh, okay, I get it. You got to have some money before they don't tell you about that. Slavery and human rights are diametrically opposed to one another. And if they ever taught you that you were born with rights, you wouldn't have no college. Most of you are out here trying to get a degree, right? Am I right? So for what reason? I know you don't want to say it, do we? You don't want to say it. So I can eat. So I can live. Right? Right? What if you didn't have to do this for the things you needed to live? Would you be here? Ron, turn your back.
I want to watch this.
You're here because there has been interference ran in the natural way things are done. What if they required that an elephant have to come here to do the same thing? All right, get away from the water. That's Mr. Cartwright's water. Where's your utility bill? What if they told that to elephants? I dare say more elephants would probably not have water in their houses, right? What if they said it to the chipmunk? Chipmunk be like, what you talking about, man? I don't know what you're talking about, right? What if they said it to anything else in nature? To the squirrel, leave those nuts alone. Let me validate your link card real quick here. Squirrel would have to go out of business as a squirrel, wouldn't it? Right? That's why it's so difficult for you to vibe on a human level. Because the natural way of existence you've been taken out of. And you've been put into the predator mode. Constantly in search of the things you need to live. I dare say that if every waking moment you spend in search of the things you need to live, you can't help but to have one state of mind, and that is the mind of a predator. Am I right? They tell me I came from the project, that's why I got this attitude. You know how they are over there, right? But everybody's in the same predator mode because everybody's in constant search of the things they need to live. Hell, and if you get something up in here, we was talking about this at lunchtime. Your biggest fear is what? You ain't got nothing. You'll never get nothing. And if you get something, what's your biggest fear?